Chow Shen, ma'am.
And Maya Shone. Today we have a very special program for the celebration of Martin Luther King and this special WBAI fund drive devoted to works of Martin Luther King. We have with us on the air William Pepper, who is both an American attorney and an English barrister. Bill is probably familiar to most of you here at WBAI. Aside from the international human rights law that he practices and as well teaches seminars at Oxford University, Bill Pepper is the author of two extremely important books on the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Orders to Kill, The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King, and An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. Today we will discuss with Bill the assassination, the planned government attempts to assassinate him, and how they affected it. And also today we're going to hear an excerpt from one of the most important of Dr. Martin Luther King's many significant speeches. And this is the presentation at the right there in New York at the Riverside Church at a meeting of clergy and laity concerned. This is the April 4th, 1967, Beyond Vietnam. It's a landmark speech in which Dr. King called for an end to the war in Vietnam, an end to the bombing, and also that those who were to be drafted, both ministers and young men in the United States, would apply to be conscientious objectors. In other words, that they not participate in what he considered a heinous act against the Vietnamese people and also a heinous act against the poor of the United States. So today, these two boxed offers that we're presenting of the many premiums that are being offered by WBAI today are, one, A Call to Conscience, The Landmark Speeches of Martin Luther King, Jr. It's a seven-CD box set usually offered by WBAI for $200. Today, for your premium of $150, this will be yours. And it includes, as I mentioned, Beyond Vietnam, but also The Birth of a New Nation from 1957, Give Us the Ballot, his address at the Prayer Pilgrimage for Freedom, his speech at the Great March on Detroit from 1963, the most significant I Have a Dream address at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom of August 63, and many more, and ending with the April 3rd, 1968, I've Been to the Mountaintop. The other box set, A Knock at Midnight, Inspiration from the Great Sermons of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr., is an 8-CD set. Again, today, for this special day of devoted to Martin Luther King, WBAI is giving this as its gift to you for your contribution of $150. And this includes some of the very significant sermons of Dr. Martin Luther King, such as Rediscovering Lost Values or Loving Our Enemies and Three Dimensions of a Complete Life. So, Bill, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi,
hey,
welcome.
Bill.
We're so glad to have you with us today. As I had mentioned, we're going to start with a portion, the first 11 minutes of Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. And this was at a moment in Dr. Martin Luther King's work in which you were actually working with him and discussing with him the war in Vietnam. And this is a real turning point. And we had discussed with you about how this speech and the work that Dr. Martin Luther King was doing subsequent to it was a real antecedent for the actual decision to effect his execution.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so, Michael, should we begin? This is, again, April 4th, 1967, at a meeting of clergy and laity concerned that took place at Riverside Church in New York, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight
Because my conscience leaves me no other choice. I join you in this meeting because I'm in deepest agreement with the aims and work of the organization which has brought us together, clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam. The recent statements of your executive committee are the sentiments of my own heart, and I found myself in full accord when I read its opening lines. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do, in the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must move on. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak. And we must rejoice as well. For surely this is the first time in our nation's history that a significant number of its religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us. If it is, let us trace its movements and pray that our own inner being may be sensitive to its guidance, for we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around us. Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask. And when I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I'm nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary tonight. I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation. This speech is not addressed to Hanoi or to the National Liberation Front. It is not addressed to China or to Russia. Nor is it an attempt to overlook the ambiguity of the total situation and the need for a collective solution to the tragedy of Vietnam. Neither is it an attempt to make North Vietnam or the National Liberation Front paragons of virtue, nor to overlook the role they must play in the successful resolution of the problem. While they both may have justifiable reasons to be suspicious of the good faith of the United States, life and history give eloquent testimony to the fact that conflicts are never resolved without trustful give and take on both sides. Tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. And so we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last three summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos, without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government, for the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent.
You've been listening to one of the most incredible of Martin Luther King Jr.'s many momentous speeches. This is Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. This is just a small portion of the speech. He goes on to be very concrete about what people in the United States should do, including not serving in this violent attack against peoples of the world and this violent attack against peoples of the United States themselves. This speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence, is one of the many speeches in A Call to Conscience, the landmark speeches of Martin Luther King Jr., a 7-CD set, yours for your donation to WBAI listener-sponsored radio of $150, 212-209-2950. And also, please, the 8-CD set, Inspiration from the Great Sermons of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. is also available, $150. And I urge you today, call 212-209-2950. And please call while we're discussing with Bill Pepper, because that's what we're going to do for the rest of the program. 212-209-2950, the landmark speeches of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Ralph?
Yes. Well, Bill, in your two extraordinary books, Orders to Kill and An Act of State, you delineate the systemic involvement of all of the agencies of repression, military, and intelligence in preparing the execution of Martin Luther King. In fact, on page 414 of Orders to Kill, you write, Dr. King was targeted throughout the last year of his life under the surveillance of one military intelligence group team or another. And you identify Warren and Murphy as part of an 8-man operation detachment, the Alpha 184 team, a special forces field team in specialized civilian disguise. In short, the organized role of the American authorities, of their military and intelligence, with the specific circumstances of his execution, are laid out in meticulous detail. Bill, would you address that in relation to how the structure of the military and intelligence has been deployed not merely for execution, but for control over the affairs of the country at large?
Well, I think it's important to see the military establishment and its wide ranges of agency involvement being foot soldiers in terms of ultimately in terms of the control of stability and the society itself. They come on the scene as they did in the case of Martin King's assassination as an assassination operation, only as a last resort, with a view to getting rid of a leader who had become ultimately unacceptable and impossible to control. If they could manage control through the whole range of manipulation, disinformation, public relations, and activity, they of course would have done it that way. Assassination is the final element, and it has to do always with keeping a modicum of apparent physical stability in the system, and you know, 75%, Ralph, of the GDP of this country, of this republic, emanates from consumption. Has to do with consumers going out and buying and buying and buying. If consumers don't buy, this system tends to implode. And I think we're slowly seeing that happen now. But the way that corporate media serving corporate control must operate, and ultimately in its alliance with the military industrial complex that, you know, Dwight Eisenhower alerted us to many, many years ago, and at the end of his term of office, that comes in and is tied together, but comes in a violent way only when nothing else works. But there is this effort always amongst the dominant masters of this republic just to let things go on. And anyone like a king who ultimately decides that enough is enough and no more shall be allowed in the face of our conscience is greeted ultimately with death. And so the last year of his life, they took this decision consciously to eliminate him. I only knew him the last year of his life. I had not a clue about this. You know, we were naive young people with a dream that we could remake this republic and the world. And we had no clue of the extent of control and the degree to which they were willing to go.
Well,
neither did Martin, actually.
Well, what's significant about this speech, where he joins with the clergy and laity concerned, is how specific he is later in the speech, and I thoroughly recommend everybody contribute, if you don't already have this box set, to see the evolution of these presentations, is how specific he is of the actions people can take, and that subsequent to this speech is the organization of the Four People's Campaign and the mass mobilization. The intention was in spring of 68 to gather 500,000 people, half a million people, for an encampment in Washington, D.C. And this is an encampment at a time when the military force and the policing force is outside of the United States. So it would have been very difficult to contain. And then with the garbage worker, the sanitation workers in Memphis, earlier in March, there was the actual incorporation of King's efforts combining civil rights with the workers' movement and labor. So
there's no question about that. But he was never going to be allowed to bring that half million people to Washington. That's absolutely critical to understand. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more in Vietnam, and they didn't have them to give to him. They didn't have the troops to put down what they believed would be a revolution on the streets of Washington. You got to understand, Maya, I'm sure you do, 100 cities burned that year. There was enormous anxiety. There was a virtual revolution that almost became actualized in the streets of Paris. It was only that the communist labor unions and two major labor unions sold out, or there would have been a revolution in France on the streets of Paris. They were very conscious of all of this.
Well, 68.
And believed strongly Martin's movement, his encampment, would become a revolutionary movement that they couldn't contain. He was never going to be allowed, now we see this in retrospect, never going to be allowed to bring that mass of humanity to Washington.
That's what I'm saying, is that the mass mobilization, in keeping with the events that were going on throughout the world in different parts of Europe, Latin America, and here in the United States, city after city, it was clear with the speech that he was on the road towards a clear set assassination policy, that the infiltration of his organization, the wiretapping of his home and his offices and
surveillance. Yeah, that had been going on for many years.
Right.
That had been going on for many years.
Right. And you note in Act of State that in December 63, the FBI met to figure out, quote, how to neutralize King as an effective Negro leader, end quote. And here what we have is moving beyond being a civil rights leader. We have him mobilizing the entire country.
Yes, that's true. He civil rights was in the background. He had now become major, a human rights leader, and in fact was emerging clearly as a revolutionary leader. And he was really a Jeffersonian advocate. He believed in Jeffersonian politics and Jeffersonian democracy, and the necessity of the equivalent of revolution every generation to cleanse the body politic. And that, of course, has been unpalatable, and that's an aspect of Jefferson's legacy that has been virtually written out of American history books. But he had become increasingly radicalized, as people of conscience must when they are confronted with what he saw. And that was in that last year of his life. I saw him, you know, I saw him weep. In my presence, he wept when he saw the photographs that I showed him of the results of American tax dollars and the use of napalm and white phosphorus on children and the aged and an ancient culture, ancient people who for 1,000 years tried to secure their own freedom against the forces of money and greed that forever wanted to dominate. And he wept. He said, I can no longer be a part of such a system. I must try to change it. And, of course, he crossed the Rubicon in his own sense. You know.
Of course, the question of the oppression of blacks in the United States, the targeting of the most exploited sector of the working class, always poses the issue, inevitably, of who rules. It's after all, Vietnam is but the late and little continuation of imperial hegemony from every locus across the planet. The first great genocide of the 20th century was the extermination of the population of the Philippines in the course of that subjugation, close to 2 million casualties and deaths in that occupation, and the visiting of that fate upon indigenous Native Americans. The nature of capitalist and imperialist rule is in subjugation and suppression and the destruction of entire populations. Vietnam is a continuation of imperial policy, but not its genesis. And surely in that regard, the addiction of U.S. Economic existence to arms production, which has been a characteristic of capitalist economy, was intensified with the Great Depression, and something like $40 trillion have been allocated to this undertaking, cannibalizing the infrastructure of the United States, to at any point, at any juncture, address that reality and mobilize people in their own survival interests, poses for the rulers the future and the stability and survivability of the system. Bill, in Orders to Kill, you lay out that, and it's rather ironic that the speech at Riverside Church was on April 4th, and Martin Luther King's assassination at the Lorraine Hotel occurred on April 4th of 1968.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me?
1 year later to the day, yes.
Yes, to the day. But you're right, Bill, that during the approximately 30-minute session in Memphis, the Special Forces hit team was left in no doubt as to its mission. They were to shoot to kill, body mass, center chest and cavity, Martin Luther King and Andrew Young. And as you write, no one on the team had any hesitation about killing the sacks of an excrement. The two-man sniper unit, Warren was the spotter and Murphy, the shooter and Murphy the spotter. Sam provided details about the physical structure and layout of Lorraine. Interestingly, Bill, you describe how they were, quote, friendlies, unquote, who were not wearing ties, i.e., the killer units were made aware of their plants, the U.S. government plants in Martin Luther King's circle. And I think it's fair to say that none of us and no movement and no group of those who are involved in struggle have not been targeted for the friendlies in our circle who are in liaison with those who represent the killer squads of the authorities. You say as well, Bill, on, that orders came from the offices of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they were issued under the anti-black terrorist operation Garden Plot, which is part of the overall United States Command, a specific operation called Think Strike. The orders were circulated within the highest levels of government. They were sent to the White House. The decoding of the initials used confirmed precisely where the orders were sent. This is central to the structure of power in the United States. The execution of Martin Luther King, his targeting for that purpose over a sustained period of time, the attempts to destroy the movement not merely through his decapitation, but through the ongoing COINTEL elimination operations, because how many people in the Black Panther movement, in the struggle for black liberation, in the struggle against exploitation within the United States, have disappeared from view under the aegis of these killer operations at the highest level of authority.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that this killer movement spread throughout the United States. I mean, the people who provided us with the information had been assigned to other cities with mug books to kill and to shoot community leaders who were similarly provocative and thought to be revolutionary. Potential revolutionary leaders, and so there's no doubt this was a part of a massive movement. King, of course, was critical because of his power and his ability to mobilize people and bring them. But you know, there's no plausible deniability here, Ralph and Maya, all the way up the line. You know, a Johnson might at some point say, well, of course, he would not have to know the details, but he would know what was going to happen. But he would on a need to know basis, he didn't know the details. That was coordinated by the people who had to carry out the operation, and in particular the 902s, which was the military intelligence group. In the bowels of the Pentagon, responsible to the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, Bill Yarbrough. So there was an actual chain of command awareness all the way up, but the details would really only have been known by the colonel who coordinated all aspects of the killing of Martin King, including the deal with the Marcello organization that put the weapon in the hands of the assassin and the money in the pockets of all of those who had to aid and abet it. So it was a civilian assassination, but without any doubt there was a military backup there. Absolutely no doubt about that at all. And two members of that team were the main sources for Steve Tompkins, who was my main contact over 2 years of exchanging information with these people, and they had fled to Mexico in the 70s because they were convinced there was a cleanup operation and they had to get out.
Right, Bill, but when we talk about civilian, whether we're dealing with Raul or we're dealing with that component of the mob that's integrated within the operations of intelligence, they are put into motion by the intelligence agencies of the U.S. ruling class.
They're not
volunteers in this enterprise.
Oh, no. This whole operation was coordinated by an Army colonel who was a CIA. Operative, like a lot of these chaps, he had, you know, dual agency involvement.
You know, I wanted to mention something, Bill, in regard to the murder of Martin Luther King. you referenced Dwight Eisenhower's speech about the military-industrial complex, and indeed there are sectors of capital who were concerned with the use of mass military involvement in operations, but Kennedy was one of these. But interestingly, Dwight Eisenhower was extremely interested in solving the problems of imperialism by reference to assassination. He gave the nod for the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. It was under Dwight Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles that Arbenz government was overthrown by a CIA putsch in Guatemala.
Yeah, and Mossadegh.
Shah was installed in Iran with the putsch that overthrew Mossadegh. The Kennedy brothers themselves were obsessed
with Lebanon
in the 58.
Invasion of Lebanon.
The plans to murder Abdul Karim Qasim in Baghdad after the Iraqi Revolution, 1958 and 1959, when Abdul Karim Qasim confined the oil companies to 0.1% of the territory of Iraq. That was under John Kennedy's watch. The Kennedy brothers obsessed with Green Berets and with Phoenix programs and with the James Bond alternative, a massive military engagement. These are quarrels or struggles within the ruling class about the means of subjugation. Whereas I like to analogize the assassination of the Kennedy brothers to the question of who killed Caesar, and the murder of Malcolm and Martin Luther King to, if you like, the crucifixion. In one prior instance with the Eisenhowers and Kennedys, there are struggles about the spoils, how to divide them, how to maintain them. And in the other, it's the decapitation of the leaders and voices of the oppressed.
Well, I think that's basically accurate. I think that what I have learned, I've been given a fair amount of material of Jack Kennedy's memos and thinking and speeches from French intelligence sources I came to know in my work on the King case, which have never been seen in America. And I think one of the tragic problems with the Kennedys is that they really never gave up a basic ultimate hope in the possibility of liberal capitalism changing its face and taking on a social conscience and pushing that social conscience forward. The approach was that military oppression and unequal dealings throughout the world was not the way to go, but was not necessary. There was a softer a capitalist touch. Jack Kennedy would have been very much wanted very much the Peace Corps, very much softer movements in Latin and South America. In fact, said very pronouncedly at one point, either there will be an accommodation with the wretched of this continent so that they have a decent life, or there will be revolutions that will come and will be beyond our ability to control. I think he recognized that the necessity, but was hoping that in some ways it could be changed. I think in terms of Eisenhower, you're absolutely right. He presided over the time when Arbenz was overthrown in Guatemala and Mossadegh, and most tragically Mossadegh in Iran, where we're still visiting the results of that overthrow of a nationalist leader who was concerned for his people. But Eisenhower slowly, gradually began to see toward the end, I think, the futility of this and of the menace of the individuals and the forces that had been advising him and with whom he had agreed for so long. I think at the end of his day, it's not that he was becoming any way a radical a political figure in American history, but I think almost out of frustration, he realized, as a man whose conscience at the end of his time had to speak out, that this was not going to work. This was not just, and this was not the way to go.
Well, Bill, if I may differ with you, I don't think it's a question of conscience at all. It's a question of recognition of who are the agents of capitalism with whom you align. As I'd like to refer again to this wonderful speech by Martin Luther King, because in fact the forces of capitalism are evidenced in the effect of what happens when you have a full massive scale war are quite apparent to Dr. King. He had hopes when you have manufacturing capitalism, there's a bit of surplus in the society, that there is a poverty program, that you can take a little bit of the excess from the taxation and it goes into ameliorating, not really changing the lives of the poor, but some amelioration. And what he saw with the war in Vietnam is not only were poor blacks and poor whites cannon fodder for this massive machine, but in fact, the war machine, the money that goes to mass armaments, is also absorbs all the resources of society. Just as we see now with the war in Iraq, where $1 trillion of discretionary government funding goes to a small sector of the capitalist ruling class, the armed industry.
I think that's right.
There is a big difference with the Kennedys and their allegiance with manufacturing capital and their hope that with secret teams like Green Berets, you can affect changes rather than having mass armaments and troop. But Kennedy did send in the troops, and what we have here with Dr. King is this realization, and I want to go back to urging people to call and to have for your own the landmark speeches of Martin Luther King, 212-209-2950. Included is not only the amazing speech at the Riverside Church 1 year to exactly before his assassination, but we have the I Have a Dream, his acceptance speech 2 years previously to this speech of the of when he received the Nobel Peace Prize, his eulogy for the young victims of the Birmingham church bombing, and I've Been to the Mountaintop, the last speech he gave before his death. 212-209-2950 for your contribution to listener-supported radio, WBAI of $150. Remember, were it not for your contributions, the conversation that we're having today with Bill Pepper would not be heard. It is only here on WBAI on programs such as Taking Aim, brought to you week by week because of the contribution of each and every one of us, brothers and sisters, $150 contribution. And with this contribution, you not only have the benefit of WBAI, you have the incredible, incredible presentations in this 7-CD set. Ralph?
Well, we're dealing here today with the question of the execution, and as Bill calls it, the execution of Martin Luther King in an act of state. It was an organized execution at the highest levels of authority, and it proceeded from a long-standing plan to destroy the mobilization of a political force that could challenge the power, the structure of power in our society. The question as to revolution and reform has always been addressed by leaders of struggle. Rosa Luxemburg articulated it quite well in a book by that title, in which she described how the moment when masses are mobilized and the mobilizations that they give rise to are outside of the control politically of the rulers, that's when concessions are made in the form of reform. And immediately it's the political task of the rulers is to then channel disaffection on the part of the oppressed into political vehicles that are under the aegis of the rulers themselves.
Right.
As soon as we are demobilized, as we're picking and choosing amongst the agents of those who rule, whoever they may be, and with whatever rhetoric about change and reform and this, that, and the other, as soon as the movement is demobilized, those concessions in the form of reforms are taken back. They are liquidated. They disappear. So the paradox of this is that reform itself is only achieved by mobilizations of the oppressed outside of the control of the rulers. That's when they make those concessions. But the question for us is how we translate struggle into a political challenge to those who have power, because the execution of Martin Luther King, like that of Malcolm X 3 years prior, as the targeting of those who resist the predations of the 1% of our people that owns more than 95% of the rest of us combined, we will always be confronted by attempts to decapitate movements with assassination, by COINTEL programs that target those of us who struggle and resist, reinvent people through either personal or character assassination. That's part of the paradigm of state power and the ruling class operations. But here, with the anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King, when we're describing the elimination of an extraordinary voice, we have to, I think, draw the lesson as to what struggle means and what it takes to change the structure of power in a society such as our own. And again, I think the most extraordinary thing that emerges from the work that Bill has done, as expressed in these two books, is to document beyond any doubt the overwhelming institutional nature of these assassination programs and how they're linked to military rule in this country. I mean, the structures that Bill lays out of the Operation Garden Plot, of the military control, of the various military intelligence units, they're in every part of this country. They're within every major population center of this country. They are, notwithstanding the formal prohibitions against these operations by the military and by the CIA, they are ubiquitous, and they are in place. And we have, no entitlement to any illusion about the fact that power will not be taken in this country by pleading for it, by asking nicely, by having the expectation that if we voice our views in an organized way, that those who have power on behalf of less than 1% of the population are going to concede it voluntarily. It will take a very sustained struggle that poses the question of who rules and does it at the point of production.
And, Ralph, that is why this speech in particular is so significant to me. And, I want to repeat the number, 212-209-2950. It's one of these speeches that you can listen to over and over and over again and learn from, learn the not just the structure of rhetoric, but the passion combined with it and how to be particular, as well as to honor and share with young people and people who may not have ever heard these speeches at the time. 1967, the landmark speeches of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., A Call to Conscience. I want to read just a couple of sentences from it. He says, "We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible." And Martin Luther King was explicit in how one could protest and how one could organize that protest. And he says, "We are at a moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his conviction. But we must all protest." You cannot be clearer than that. Everyone must be engaged. And later on, he says, "The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. And if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and laymen concerned committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end, unless there is a significant and profound change in American life and policy. And we end with that statement of his. It's exactly what Ralph was saying. It's exactly what Bill was saying. We must all contribute. We must all organize. We must all learn, have intelligent protest. And that is why we must maintain WBAI on the air. This station cannot survive without your contributions. And these words of Martin Luther King should be in each and every one of our homes and should be a beacon of light and an inspiration to us all, as well as a means for which we, with which we can, a means to educate our children, our grandchildren, and our friends. A Call to Conscience, the landmark speeches of Martin Luther King Jr., your contribution to WBAI for $150. It's a 7-CD, beautifully boxed set, along with written material from many people to complement the speeches. $150, 212-209-2950 for your support of Taking Aim, for your support of WBAI, and most of all, for your support of yourself. Ralph?
Well, Bill, of course, what the lessons of the murder of Martin King teach us are the continuation of the forms of oppression that took his life and the continuation of the need to find the will and the ability to mobilize our population for a struggle to displace those in power. And after all, with the events of September 11th, which we have discussed and which we have been engaged, you and I and many others, we see clearly the criminal nature of the state which murders the most extraordinary of its citizens, is a state that is capable of any perfidy and of every deception. There is no openness about the way power is wielded, and there can be, therefore, I think, no illusion about the bona fides and the intentions of those who have power in this society. It's interesting to note, by the way, that military and intelligence advisors of every candidate in both parties are drawn from the same structures and the same very persons. The Brzezinski brothers are the national security advisors of Barack Obama, along with Anthony Lake, and the continuity. And Philip Zelikow is there in the mix. And you see, brothers and sisters, that what Martin Luther King aspired to do could not be achieved within the framework of the two capitalist parties. And Bill was a central figure with Martin Luther King at the end of his life in organizing a political resistance, a political organization outside of the two parties. Bill, do you want to address the new politics efforts that...
That ultimately we came to that conclusion. Martin asked me to head the National Conference for New Politics, which was a huge umbrella group spread across the country for the purpose of developing a third-party movement. And it contained a remarkable coalition of movement people from the liberal, northeastern liberals in the same nuclear, anti-nuclear program to Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and Black Panthers and a whole wide range of people. And the idea, 5,000 delegates came to the convention in Chicago over Labor Day. Unfortunately, in our naivete, we didn't realize the strength of the ability of government to infiltrate and to produce provocateurs who could undermine that entire movement. But the idea was that there would be this independent political force of King and Benjamin Spock that would oppose Lyndon Johnson and his return to power and would be an anti-war force. I think we believed at that point, as many of these young volunteers for Obama and Edwards and Clinton do today, that what they're doing is going to enhance democracy in the Republic and really have an effect. And I only say that because I look back on our naivete at that point, and I see it mirrored in the naivete of the tremendous youthful energy across the country today. And it's unfortunate that the politics of reality have not caused young people, somehow we've not given them the legacy where they can be radicalized and understand how the system is controlled and how it works, and what their how their energies will in fact be corrupted and used, and when they believe that in a sense functioning within this existing political milieu that they can bring about the change that will never be brought about ultimately by conventional political action. But on 15th of April 1967, Martin said, "You will address this massive group," which I did at the UN, "and why don't you float this idea," which I did, "of a third party ticket." And of course that it took off, and you know, in this political tradition, people thought this was marvelous, because he was, as Maya said, a figure, you know, who stood apart from a power structure and appeared to be incorruptible, and people rallied to that. And
what's wonderful about this is a party that's independent of the Democratic and Republican.
Yeah.
This is not people going out working for Barack Obama and supporting the powers of capital. At the time, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the Black Panthers, they were creating a political structure that was independent of the powers of capital, independent of the ruling class. And this is where Martin Luther King saw the direction, mass mobilization, building from the base, and the power of the people, the true power of the people.
Right.
And that is why, as soon as he set himself upon this path, where it was no longer legislation through Congress and the Poverty Act legislation or the civil rights legislation, no longer that, no longer pleading with the power of capital, but in fact mass organizing.
But Maya,
from that day forward, they had to assassinate.
Absolutely right. Maya, I believe the country at that point was in a pre-revolutionary situation. And I believe what would have happened in Washington would have been similar to what was happening on the streets of Paris. And I believe that, in a sense, the military was right, because the frustration and the anger of the wretched of America would have risen up, and their energy would not have been suppressed, and there would have been a revolution at that point in time. Now, whether it would have been peaceful or violent, I'm not in a position to even think about at this point. We were there then, and I suggest, Ralph and Maya, we are there once again.
You're there again, Bill.
Revolutionary situation.
And if that, with those words, please take aim with Ralph Shoman and Maya Shone. Our programs are available on our internet site, www.takingaimradio.com. Follow the clock sharp. Please call 619-209-2950 and this incredible 17-bed call to contact Martin.